Welcome to Educated Conjecture, an Ipsos podcast that combines what the public thinks with what the experts think. Each week, Ipsos's Mike College and Sean Simpson are joined by an informed guest to discuss the issues of the day. In this episode, Mike and Sean talk about cryptocurrency with two guests, Kimberly Grauer, Director of Research at Chainalysis, and Eric Jardine, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Virginia Tech, and co-author of Look Who's Watching, Surveillance, Treachery, and Trust Online. Although still in the minority, increasing numbers of Canadians believe that paper money and coins won't exist in 10 years, and confidence in digital currency is growing. What is cryptocurrency? Who's using it around the world? And what is contributing to its growth? Our guests help us explore these issues. And now, on to the episode.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode, podcast, whatever you want to call it, of Educated Conjecture. Sean, how are you today, my friend?
I'm cold, Mike. How are you?
You're cold. Do you know what? I'm a little bit warmed up today because it's podcast day, and I'm a little more excited on the days we record and we bring in people to, who are always, as you know, our entire goal is to bring people who are a lot smarter than us to fill in our gaps in our knowledge, and that's always a good day for me.
It's a heartwarming sentiment, for sure.
I don't know if it's warm enough to not numb the 30 minus 34 that it was this morning in Ottawa, but we'll work on it.
Well, I'm just a little bit annoyed because I was having icicle problems on my eaves troughs, so I got new eaves troughs, and the icicles are back. So I'm not entirely sure what I just spent all the money
for. It's not an eaves trough problem. It's a roof problem.
Well, unfortunately.
That's a different.
I got a new roof, too, so I don't know what my
problem is. That's a different podcast, Sean.
Yeah. Okay, we'll get a roofer in the next time.
Excellent. Do you have a stat of the day, stat of the week that you want to rattle off?
I do. It was a stat that we recently released with our partners Global News, and it showed that 21%, one in five Canadians, would stop being friends with someone else based on their vaccination status. Mm-hmm. I mean, that just underscores the divisions that this pandemic is creating, not just, between men and women or by generations, but on people's doorsteps as well, and who they're going to choose to be friends with. And 20% doesn't sound like a lot, but that's over 5 million Canadian adults who would stop being friends with someone else. I just found that to be mind-blowing, and I thought I'd share it with you today.
Well, I'm not friends with you anymore because that was going to be my stat of the day because I thought – but you sent it to me in advance, so I was able to adjust. But I agree. It points to the both the division and the level of frustration, I think, that people are looking for some place to focus their frustration. So I went and dug into a few things, and because of who we have in our guests today, which I know you're going to choose in a second – I went in and I looked at our next study, which is where we asked Canadians to cast forward on a whole range of things technology related the next 10 years and think about where things are going to go. And I wanted to pull out two that I thought were interesting around digital currency. So 38% of Canadians say that they believe that in the next 10 years, paper money and coins won't exist anymore. So you have 4 in 10 who say it's going to disappear, much higher amongst men. That's up 10 points since 2017 when we first started track. And the other one was confidence in a system of money that's entirely digital. 30% of Canadians express, say, I would be confident if we got rid of all those things and it was entirely digital, I'd be good to go. And that's up 6 points since 2017. So two where, to your point, not majority numbers, but when you think about where the world's going and you think about how much higher those numbers are, and they are much higher amongst particularly millennials and millennial men, there's a clear indication of a willingness and acceptance and a desire to move in that direction.
Fascinating. And I suspect that'll grow then if there's a willingness.
Well, it's grown since 2017, so.
Well, without further ado, I'll take this opportunity to introduce our two guests. I think this is the first time that we've had two guests on at the same time, so a lot of brain power here today. Our two guests, the first one is Eric Jardine. He is assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Virginia Tech. I've worked with him for the better part of a decade now on a whole bunch of different things. About Eric, in 2014, he was awarded his PhD in International Affairs at the Norman Patterson School of International Affairs at Carleton University. So he's a Canadian guy. He is co-author of Look Who's Watching, Surveillance, Treachery, and Trust Online. And I came to know Eric when he was a research fellow at the Center for International Governance Innovation in Waterloo, where much of his research focused on internet trust, cryptocurrency, and governance. Our other guest joining us today is Kim Grauer. And actually, I didn't confirm the pronunciation of your name, Kim, so correct me if I'm wrong. But she's the director of research at Chainalysis, Inc., which creates transparency for a global economy built on blockchains, enabling banks, businesses, and governments to have a common understanding of how people use cryptocurrency. And I'm one of those people who you're going to have to teach so that I have a common understanding with the rest of you on all things crypto. Kim earned her Master's of Political Theory from Oxford, followed that up with a Master's of Political Administration from the London School of Economics and Political Science. And we have two of them with us who are very smart. And Mike, I think you're going to learn a lot today.
I am at like cryptocurrency 101, so I just am dying to hear what we're going to talk about. So,
well, welcome, Eric. Welcome, Kim. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
So on that crypto 101, just so that we're all starting on the same page, and I don't know who wants to answer this question, Eric or Kim. What's our primer on cryptocurrency? What is it? Who's using it?
Why should we care?
Yeah, why should we care? Do I need to worry about it?
An initial primer on cryptocurrency. I like to sort of go back to the beginning and think about the problem that was solved with the introduction of the technology itself. And so when you're dealing with something like a digital currency, and, you know, Mike, you raised these stats that I think are super interesting with at least the Canadian population sort of forecasting this is going to be the way that we go. The big problem with anything digital is it's infinitely copyable. And so if you're talking about a dollar or you're talking about a JPEG or you're talking about a file, you can copy it an infinite number of times. And that creates what's known as the double spend problem. And the double spend problem basically means if I was transacting with Sean using a digital asset, I could give Sean a copy of that asset, retain a copy, and then give a copy of that to you, Mike, and then I've double spent my asset. So banks right now, in a centralized way, they solve that by basically keeping the books on their sort of centralized servers. And so when you're, you know, taking money out of your bank account with your debit card or your Visa debit card or whatever it happens to be, the bank's keeping a transaction record. They're going to make sure you don't spend money that you don't have. And if you do go into the negative, there's a fee and they keep track of all of these things. Now, trying to do that without that third party intermediary is where you really are run into problems. And that's what the introduction of Bitcoin solved. So Satoshi, whomever that happens to be, or whatever group that happens to be, basically proposed a way through the blockchain and through proof of work to essentially solve that double spend problem by allowing a distributed network to all have access to the blockchain record of who owns what at what point in time, and to update that in periodic intervals as you update the blocks. So when you're talking about cryptocurrency, what you're really talking about is a way, at least as a currency. I mean, there's a whole bunch of other things like metaverse and NFTs and all those other things we can talk about. But as a cryptocurrency, what you're really talking about is a way to solve that double spend problem while remaining decentralized as opposed to relying on a centralized third party.
And who's using it then? Like for whom does this solve the problem? Is it banks and others who were noticing that they were being left out, and so it was their solution, or was the solution more from a consumer who needed to be able to transact in that way?
I actually, you know, this was something that I was really interested in answering as well, because one of the things that we do at Chainalysis, which is essentially a blockchain data platform, is we kind of made our name researching criminal activity and how people using blockchains and cryptocurrencies would carry out criminal activity with digital assets. And we realized, hey, that's about 1% of all economic activity. And then our bosses and our CEO and other people were like, well, what about the other 99%? You guys only talk about crime, but the biggest amount of activity is non-criminal activity. There's meaningful economic activity happening on the blockchain between exchanges, between services. Who is that? So we commissioned kind of a study, and we through kind of a cool process, what my company does is we identify services that accept cryptocurrency, and those services have a geographic footprint. So Coinbase or Gemini, for example, mostly have a US footprint, and you can see that from their web traffic. And what we found was actually that this asset class is being used all around the world, and there's not one use case. So in Canada and in the United States are going to be experiencing the use of cryptocurrency in a different way than people in Venezuela or people in Kenya and Nigeria, where there's substantial amounts of cryptocurrency activity today. And so I think that depending on where you are sitting, you're going to get a different answer. One of the biggest countries that had the most adoption this year was Vietnam. And when you go in and you talk to people in Vietnam, you see, we learned about that, you know, we did hear a lot about a propensity for gambling and that being a part of the attractiveness. But also there's a young tech savvy population of people who don't have access to traditional financial markets to invest in and want something to do with their money and want to feel like they're being financially proactive in how they invest their money. And cryptocurrency is kind of filling that niche in a way that maybe feels a little bit more accessible to a younger population. But again, every country is different and warrants kind of a dissertation in its own right.
But there's only 100 some odd countries, so we can start the dissertation and fill the rest of the podcast. That's super interesting, because in some of the stuff work we see globally around technology and some of the things I've looked at, tech adoption in general tends to happen amongst younger populations. So the younger the population in the country, the more likely they are. And I've also noticed that on some of these issues, if they don't have the same, I'm just going to ask the question is, are developing countries using it more because they don't have the same level of bank infrastructure? So I think on those countries moved to mobile internet services faster than cable and hard base. They just skipped the process, right? Because they didn't have them. So is the same thing happening with cryptocurrency?
Yeah, definitely. And again, it will depend on which country we're talking about. And there's not one reason why someone wakes up in the morning and decides I'm going to get into cryptocurrency. It's many reasons happening all at once, but what is available, and we know there's a lot of people who don't have access to traditional banking infrastructure, but all of a sudden their buddy is telling them that, hey, there's this app that you can download and you can receive cryptocurrency from anywhere in the world. And hey, maybe you want to start a remittances business. And we talked to a few people who literally started their own business educating people on how to carry out international cryptocurrency payments in, you know, low and middle income countries, because it was an opportunity to start a business, and the demand was there, and organically they started getting more and more people who they could facilitate these payments for. And yeah, so I think that it's certainly the case if you had been left out of the financial markets previously.
So I'm super interested in some of the things that you've mentioned about crime and stuff. I just want to park that for a second because I think we'll spend most of our time there. But just so that I don't get the impression that it's all evil, what would be some of the legitimate reasons that somebody might use cryptos? I mean, you mentioned, you know, there's kind of an element of gambling there because it's up and down, of course, and playing the markets, you know, remittance, that kind of thing. Can I buy a car with it? Can I, like, what are there other, you know, online shopping? Are there other, I guess, legitimate uses for cryptocurrency that might inspire someone like me to get more involved in owning them and trading them?
Yeah, if I may comment on that, I think there's, you can buy a Tesla with Bitcoin, and I think Dogecoin now too, if I'm not mistaken. So at least at one level, that sort of thing is possible. I think generally when you're looking at like categories of illicit things that you can do or non-illegal things you could do, I mean, it kind of depends on context, as Kim was saying. And you do have, for example, the situations where, you know, traditional banking infrastructure is absent, or, you know, something like Western Union is charging usurious fees. you can circumvent those. So in those sorts of settings, just simply money transfer or value or wealth transfer can be accomplished. But the thing to also bear in mind when talking about cryptocurrencies is not just currency, and it's not, so you have Bitcoin and that's kind of like the main thing that everybody thinks of, but there are a myriad other use cases that can be sort of layered on top of blockchain. So in a setting where, for example, you don't trust government-run property registries, you could put all of that onto a blockchain, which would create a record that the government couldn't tamper with. So if you don't trust your available third parties or the third parties are gone, there's a lot of utility for blockchain. So there's a lot of ways in which you can leverage the technology and what underlies it, the sort of blockchains, to do a bunch of cool things.
Very interesting. So we do a lot of work on trust. And, you know, it's the one of the things that makes the world go round, right? But let's say I don't trust Sean. But sorry, Sean. Let's put it this way. Sean doesn't trust me. Let's say that. But I owe Sean because I lost some money on a baseball game bet, and I moved us into summer, which is excellent. Other than hand to hand cash, which I can pay him when I next time see him, to transfer it to him, we have to go through a bank that is, we're basically using as our trust maker, right? That does the coordination. So blockchain allows me to send him something, whatever, in this case, cryptocurrency, and the ledger automatically becomes my trust mark that it actually happens, right? Because it's recorded. And that's why we get to avoid the third party.
Yeah. And, you know, not to get too far into the technical weeds on it, but there's a process for validating changes to the blog. And you hear about Bitcoin and its environmental footprint from all the miners. They're actually engaged in the process of validation that's paid for with coins to the miners. There's alternatives, there's proof of stake models that are less environmentally damaging and things of that nature. But yeah, you're basically not relying on, you're placing trust in the math as opposed to placing trust in an institution. And so that's sort of the advantage, and why a lot of people, especially like those who are technologically inclined, especially in the early days, sort of latched on to the technology, because it sort of solves a problem of trust in institutions that's sort of a perennial thing in human affairs, by basically allowing you to rely upon transparent math and that you can validate yourself. So if you ever wanted to, you can download the blockchain and get that record.
You mentioned less environmentally, and I know that's something that comes up occasionally, is the environmental impact of blockchains all over. Is that being addressed through different means, or is it how big of a problem is it, I guess?
It's well,
I know you're not an environmentalist.
Right. So it's one of those things. It's, if you take the Bitcoin network and you stack it up relative to countries, it's using more than a lot of small countries, so more than Finland last time I checked, which is a sizable amount. I pulled up a number before, and it's something in the order of 113 terawatt hours a year, which is a lot. So in that sense, the validation mechanism, the proof of work that updates the blockchain, that takes a lot of power. And, you know, on the one hand, from an environmental standpoint, having a computer network use more power than nations is jarring. Don't expect something like that. Now, the things that I like to sort of add to a conversation about the environmental impact of something like Bitcoin is, first, there are alternatives. So if you have a proof of stake blockchain like Cardano, for example, the energy consumption per transaction or per year, depending on how you want to slice it, is significantly less. So you can actually do block validation through this alternative mechanism in a way that's not as environmentally costly. Additionally, it's useful to contrast it with existing alternatives. So you have like the traditional banking infrastructure, or you have gold if you want to be a gold bug and do the gold standard or something. And both of those use more energy than Bitcoin at the moment. They're obviously bigger too.
That was going to be my next question, because I've never seen the other side of this is what it's costing us today. It's just always anti-crypto comment.
Right now, Bitcoin would be probably about half the banking sector, which is big, because it still means Bitcoin's probably more environmentally costly than the banking sector, because running all those data centers for global finance is going to be taking care of global finance, whereas Bitcoin is taking care of trillions of dollars of float value, but it's still a fraction. And then the other thing to sort of bear in mind along these same lines is I wouldn't personally look at environmental costs absent the values produced for society. And that's more of an open question where you have to make a determination. Is the amount of energy you're expending on the Bitcoin network worth the gains you're getting? And, you know, I think the Bitcoin maximalists out there would probably say this is the first sound, perfectly sound money or hard money that humans have ever been able to invent. And so it will correct all sorts of problems if we adopt it. And so therefore it's worth the cost. Environmentalists would probably have a different opinion. And so
it's that's an excellent point. And that's why it's ESG and not just E.
Let's talk about crime. So you need to help me understand, what is the most, I suppose, prevalent form of crime? And I presume it's not just me trying to steal Eric's crypto. And the other thing I'm kind of curious about is, who's the victim, you know, in this crime? Is it that someone is trying to create currency and so the victim is everybody in devaluation? Or just help me think through what's happening and who's being victimized.
So I think the first thing I'd say is there's not just one type of cryptocurrency crime. There's many different types that have different victims and different impacts on society and people. And so it doesn't make sense to think of crypto crime just in this kind of vacuum and it's all criminal activity. And that being said, it also doesn't make sense to think of there just being crypto crime and then regular crime, when actually we're seeing a lot of criminals that are been around for a while are adopting cryptocurrency in their toolkit in a variety of ways. That being said, we did just release our crime report, which tries to answer this in the best way that we can. So what we found is that the biggest kind of source of criminal activity is something you might guess. It's scamming. So people just getting scammed by these investment scams. I like to say that everyone has that friend who's tried to involve them in a pyramid scheme or a Ponzi scheme. You know, I certainly have, you know, the friend
every
few years.
That's why Sean doesn't trust me.
this is the reason, exactly.
This is the reason Sean and I have an issue, but anyway.
Every few years, that friend, they're like, I got to show you this cool project that I've got. And you're like, ooh, so that is definitely a scam. And that is no different in cryptocurrency. And you have criminals who see an opportunity to potentially scam people who might be more vulnerable or more at risk of, I don't know what you say, like falling for it or something. But so those are the biggest source of criminal activity. Billions and billions of dollars are sent to these scams every single year. I think it was something like $7 billion this year was scammed off of people. And mostly these websites that say, hey, you can get 50% return for life if you just give me some money now. And so, but that's not the only type of crime. There's also hacking where I store your funds on an exchange and then that exchange is a victim of a hack. And that's actually the second biggest type of criminal activity. And there's other types of victims there because anyone could be a victim of a hack. So there are things you can do to ensure that you're securing your funds on an extra safe exchange, but you know, you never know sometimes. And then there's ransomware, there's darknet marketplaces, there's fraud shops, which are growing in prominence of people who buy your identities. I've seen passports being sold. I've seen weapons being sold on darknet markets, and we've got terrorist financing. Human trafficking is another growing thing that's happening using cryptocurrency. And I think that there's probably a few others that I missed. Malware. Malware is something that we just worked on a big case called Gloopteba with, which is kind of a cool story, but it's a bot that mines Monero on your computer without you knowing it. And so that, of course, is denominating cryptocurrency. So a wide variety of a platter of criminal activity.
You know, you mentioned if certain marketplaces or whatever get since you raided, you know, I'm thinking of a run on Fort Knox and all the money's gone. Is there a CDIC equivalent you know, like if my money ends up being scammed or stolen in that way, is there a backstop for me to get it back?
We're still kind of developing those types of policies, and so definitely not across the board. But I believe there are some exchanges that are working towards that. But it's definitely not the case. A lot of platforms, if you get hacked, then you're hacked, and if you get scammed, then you're scammed for now. And there are industry solutions that people are adopting that you couldn't do in the regular world. An exchange, Luno, recently implemented a technological way of preventing its customers from sending money to scams. So since we know what the scams are, and you try and send to a scam, nope, we're not going to let you do that. And so, I'm sure you could override that if you really wanted to. But so that's not possible in a different context. So there are different kinds of technological solutions to help prevent scamming, but we're not kind of at the place where, or at least I don't think. I mean, Eric, are you aware of that?
Well, I mean, there's the technical solutions you're pointing, and there's two layers where you could do. I could imagine a similar to traditional banks, something like an exchange could go in for some sort of deposit insurance, and they could use that as a compensatory measure in the eventuality of a scam. And this, you know, one of the newer exchanges, crypto.com, that just had a problem where money was subtracted. Maybe such a thing exists where they'd be able to do some compensation. There is one case that I've heard of, and it speaks to a crime and security related issue that I do want to bring up, where one of the big blockchains called Ethereum, they actually rolled back a crime. So I think it was in 2016, there was millions of dollars stolen. And typically speaking, Kim's absolutely right, that once something's lodged in the ledger as a new ownership wallet, there's no going back unless they decide to just voluntarily send it back to you. So you give them a sternly worded email or something. But in this particular case, Vitalik Buterin and the Ethereum team decided we are going to force a rollback in the blockchain. And that was all kinds of contentious at the time, because typically speaking, that suggests a market power equivalent to a bank where they could claw back a transaction. And that sort of works against the whole decentralized, no trusted third party ethos of the space. And so it actually led to what's known as a hard fork, and there, it sort of broke the network into two. It's the only instance I can think of where a layer one blockchain has actually said there was crime that happened, money was stolen, we don't like that, so we're taking it back. Certainly not something that you could probably affect in, say, Bitcoin, but it speaks to a layer Kim quite rightly pointed out the variety of crypto-related crime that can happen, anything from scams and markets and monetary facilitation, money laundering, and so forth. The thing that I think often gets confused with regards to, say, something like Bitcoin is the security of Bitcoin, because you'll often hear of it being insecure or vulnerable to theft or something like that. What that usually means is that the exchanges are going to be compromised and the money that's being held by the exchange gets taken out. If you're running a hardware wallet, you can lose that wallet, you can lose your passcode, and those will have an equivalent effect. But the protocol itself, actually trying to brute force a change to the Bitcoin blockchain, would be really, really hard to accomplish. There's ways it could happen, but generally speaking, it's just a useful distinction to bear in mind that at a protocol level, the blockchain is a really robust way to keep track of things. And then layered on top of that are all these sort of layer two applications and things of that nature. And those can be very vulnerable, and exchanges are vulnerable and everything like that. But Bitcoin itself is not necessarily prone to security problems, although there are known attacks. It's a distinction that I think is useful simply because you can lose your Bitcoin, but it doesn't mean Bitcoin has a problem. It means an exchange has a problem. It means that you have a problem, something of that nature.
So in the simplest mic terms, I could be scammed. There's less likely a chance I'll be hacked.
So if you were to if you were to buy Bitcoin on an exchange and transfer it to a hardware wallet or a paper wallet or something like that, and you kept that in good order, like you didn't put it in a dumpster like has happened, yeah. You didn't drop it in the ocean, you didn't otherwise lose the passcode,
yeah,
it is extraordinarily unlikely that anyone's going to get access to that.
Yeah.
If you keep it on an exchange, the exchange could be a scam, the exchange could be hacked, but you're not in physical possession of the coins at that point. You're actually relying on the exchange to do the custodial yeah. work for you. And so that, I think, like, if you use cryptocurrencies to the maximum, they're very secure. If you take an intermediate step, which is where most people probably are, of using an exchange but then keeping the money in the exchange on your behalf, because it's a lot simpler and more familiar mm-hmm. for people to look at your account balance on Coinbase.
Because it feels like a bank.
It feels like a bank, but then you're vulnerable to the same thing that typical banks would be, which is they can be hacked too. Or you can be scammed if you decide to send your money or all those sorts of things. So it's just a distinction that's useful to bear in mind that, you know, at least on the layer of losing your money through the malicious activity of somebody else, there's ways to have higher or lower levels of risk there. And, okay. and doing everything you can to take direct custodial control of your Bitcoin, for example, severely reduces your risk.
Excellent.
So I was with my buddy the other day, and he was on his phone, and he was scrolling through something. I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Well, I'm looking at my crypto." And he had, you know, 0.0001 of this one, and, you know, of another. He must have had 25, and he was, you know, looking to see if it was up or down. So that gave me an idea. I think Mike and I should start a crypto. Now, is that a difficult thing to do? I mean, it just seems to be so many of them out there that it can't be that difficult to start it up. Is there value in having so many? Are there going to be more in the future, or do you think they'll consolidate around some key players? Help me navigate this.
Well, first of all, you guys definitely should launch your own crypto, and it would go to the moon. Yeah,
you want it on the ground floor, right? Yeah, this will be good.
I think that there's pretty much. I think the smart money is that the ecosystem won't have as there will be winners and there will be losers over the, you know, near to medium to long term, and. You know, I'm not able to predict who those winners are going to be. I think that the answer is going to be in who gets the fastest to the product that, you know, we're asking at the top of the call. Are people using crypto that makes sense to people, that really has a profound use case, that makes things easier in a meaningful way? And maybe that looks like, you know, things just kind of align with our traditional banking system, and blockchains are kind of powering them in a way that you wouldn't even notice. But it also could look like, you know, Bitcoin is used internationally in a meaningful way for people to save money. And it could look like people are having a traditional savings account, but powered by Ethereum or Solana or something like that. So I don't know the answer to that, but I think that the one thing that we do know is probably many of the tokens and things we're seeing today won't be around for in a meaningful way in the future.
In the cryptocurrency world, is government regulation a bad word? Like we deal a lot with government, obviously, and I've never, in looking at public policy, seen an area where they didn't see a reason to add a layer of rules and regulation. Where are we at on this with crypto?
I think Kim could probably say more than I, but I do have I would say that the short answer to is this a bad word would be yes, from the perspective of the people who are maximally involved. And I think where that position has a point is when you draw a distinction between rules that have been kind of ported over that are more or less generally accepted, even if they kind of run counter to, say, the anonymity of the system or something like that. But like anti-money laundering rules and know your customer rules for exchanges, that would essentially mean that most participants in cryptocurrency purchases and sales, at least as they're mediated by an exchange, are going to be known and therefore identifiable at the end of the day if they're eventually undertaking some sort of criminal activity. That's generally accepted by anybody who's not out there to do criminal activity. because that's the same sort of set of rules as existed in the offline world or in the world of traditional finance, and it's just been ported over. Where I think the concern about government regulation has a point is when it comes to the potential sort of existential risk that something like Bitcoin has for fiat money. And then you have places like Russia and China, and even the US is kind of sort of toying around with giving the government a sort of an executive role where they can top-down implement through the Commerce Secretary some pretty heavy-duty changes to the way in which the industry is run. And that's where I think there's more of a space to have a debate about what is healthy regulation, because the regulation will have to be new, because you have this asset class that can challenge fiat money, and that probably scares governments because they are the issuer of fiat money.
Yeah.
So I think generally, yeah, there's that distinction between the just generally accepted, nobody but the malicious actors probably have a problem with it, or the extreme ideologues, and then the zone where governments, to protect their own monopoly, could do things that could break a $1 trillion industry, and that, I think, causes some legitimate concern.
Is it even helpful if governments act on their own, or does it have to be an international-led sort of agreement on how to regulate? Like, it's just, I feel like a patchwork of regulations from different nation states would create a lot of confusion on something that's supposed to be, I guess, relatively straightforward once you get into it and free of rules and regulations.
I would say it's far superior to have global alignment on the regulatory front. It's not what you're going to see, though. You know, that's just not, it's kind of a game theory coordination problem that you're just we're not going to get there. And then we're going to have winners and losers of the crypto space based on how governments respond to cryptocurrency. And we see that, you know, El Salvador is obviously taking a different approach than China is and how they think of regulation. And I do think that, just to comment on the last question, would be that cryptocurrency can't grow without regulation, because it can't be adopted by anyone. You can't, if it's just this asset that is swirling around with no transparency, and it could be, the funds could be coming from anywhere. There's no way that any financial actor who's regulated right now is going to be able to touch that with a 10-foot pole. So for cryptocurrency to become the asset that we're all kind of dreaming of in this industry, I think that regulation is really fundamental to that. But of course, you know, you have to regulate in a way that doesn't stifle the growth. And so it's like a fine line.
Yeah, set aside the control implications, whether crypto or digital currency in general, I think it has huge implications for how countries feel. I mean, we've put pictures on money for a reason. We put loons on dollars, those kind of things, to tell the world and to tell ourselves something about who we are. And if that all goes away, I mean, and it is going away. Eric, you have a 6-month-old, right? Correct? Yeah. So what are the chances he holds a $5 bill in his life later on, right? So, you know, these big debates about, we put so-and-so on the this or that to represent this, are going to be gone for a good chunk of the population, particularly if they live in a digital world. They're going to swoosh, they're going to crypto, they're going to do all these other things. And there's a social implication to it all. And I'm not a question, it's Mike's blathering, as Sean knows, I do occasionally.
I do know that Sweden is a good example of a country that's basically doesn't have cash right now. There's not cash. There's digital. Everything's done. I read. I don't know the percentage off the top of my head, but I read the study of just an incredibly low amount of actual cash usage.
Wasn't it Sweden though was having a challenge trying to figure out? I don't know if it's the pandemic or some other crisis, how to get money into two people. Because they couldn't write checks. They had to figure out a new way to get money to lower income groups directly from the government. Anyway, I can't remember the actual story, but I remember reading there was so much digital there. It was they're the ones that they swoosh, I believe. They call it, instead of paying someone, they just swoosh the money from one account to the other. So I have a question. Can I ask one question before? Because I know we're going to get to run out. And I actually just want to say the word non-fungible tokens. What are they? And is that a better thing for Sean and I to create than a cryptocurrency?
Fungible sounds a lot of fun to me.
Not it.
Not it.
So, yeah.
The perfectly legitimate answer is stay away from it, Mike, and I'll just be quiet. But
well, I mean, if you want to make one right now, it's the boom season. They're,
yeah.
The sort of deriding comment I've seen is you're paying a lot of money for a JPEG because at the moment they often are pictures.
Yeah.
And so it's a property record, near as I can tell, of some item, and it can be applied. Like when you start to blend it with something like, say, video games, where you can make in-game purchases, and then you have a record of who owns what, and you can trade those, and so that sort of thing. You know, okay, there may be some utility there, but it's a use case and an application that's relatively new, and I'm not yet convinced. I mean, I used to be more of a skeptic about the whole thing, and the more I've learned, the more I've seen the utility in the application to smart contracts or to even Bitcoin as a monetary instrument. But NFTs, you know, I didn't get a smartphone until 2014, so I'm a bit of a late adopter. And so when I see NFTs and see what they are at the moment, I'm underwhelmed. But you can sell them. There was a story I saw, I think it was in Canada, where a pair were selling NFTs and made $140,000 in 6 hours. So what do I know? I did not.
Sean, we need an NFT.
Yeah, there we go. That's we're doing.
I did not make $140,000 in 6 hours. So I may not be the best one to talk about this.
Just like conceptually, though, I think that the point of NFTs is maybe like cryptocurrencies is internet money. NFTs is kind of this concept of IP and ownership of digital space, and this concept of how do you prove that you own, or can you even own something digitally? I mean, we're from the internet age and everything is shared freely on the internet. I know I was pirating music from a young age, and what even is this concept of digital ownership? And I think it's an interesting kind of philosophical question, and it would change the game if you could, you know, trace that tweet to the original source in a way that is or just really truly own something digitally. I think it's an interesting concept, but the way it's been implemented so far is not convincing because of just the large, it's mostly like what Eric kind of was hinting at. It's not something that you're like, that feels like a game changer for the world and how the internet is organized. It just feels like, oh, people are making money on some cute, maybe they're cute, actually not really, pieces of art.
It seems like to me, I don't know if it's cheap is the right word, but an easy way to do digital copyright. Like Neil Young just pulled all of his stuff off of Spotify, all his music off of Spotify. He clearly has the copyright and he can make that decision. Everybody knows it's Neil Young's. We won't go into the why he did it, but it's a whole different podcast. But he said, you know what? At the end of the day, it's mine. I don't want you to play it on Spotify. And he got it pulled off. I don't own anything that's that valuable that I wouldn't that I go out there and say, no, you can't play my podcast anymore. You know, those kind of things. So it seems like it's that, right? For someone who's getting into it, I can digitally put a stamp on it and say, no, that's my picture or my drawing or my poem, or not that mine would have any values.
I have one final question for both of you. It's a two-parter. So maybe Eric, you could answer the first one and Kim will finish up. So Eric, what excites you about the future of crypto? And Kim, what concerns you about the future of crypto?
What excites? Okay. I think where I'm most excited, and so this was actually the use case that first convinced me that there may be something here, and that would be smart contracts. That the ability through the use of, say, data oracles to actually get information external to the blockchain itself, the ability to implement self-enforcing and self-implementing contracts that strikes me as something with widespread applicability that's very efficiency enhancing. And, you know, one of the things that it does is challenge the need for third-party intermediaries. So a while back, Ronald Coase posed the question, why do you have firms? If markets are efficient, market exchange, peer-to-peer market exchange should be what we do. That should be the efficient thing to do. And the argument was transaction costs mean firms are better than individuals just doing, say, barter or something like that. And I think for a lot of spaces, that's going to remain the case. But what smart contracts can let you do is essentially disintermediate in a way that will challenge some industries, and that is going to be disruptive. But it should, in theory, then be more efficient, create economic gains, streamline the way in which people interact with each other. And all of that strikes me as a real positive and yet kind of underdeveloped space. So we're not there yet, but we can, I think, move into that smart contract realm in a way that will make, similar to losing currencies and not having loony, we're also probably going to lose a lot of like iconic institutions that seem like the backbone of an economy, of a financial sector, or whatever. And that will be both sad and trying, but also I think a positive in terms of what comes next.
We're going to lose the land registry office.
Yeah, that would be a good example. Yeah, we wouldn't need it, basically. Yeah.
And so, Kim, that's your top worry then, the land registry office.
Yeah. Yes, 100%. I've been thinking I need to bring up the land registry office. But I think my biggest concern is I had some time to think about it while Eric was answering. And I think that probably there's a lot of concerns, but the biggest one is probably how governments will respond, and the concern, not just governments, but the concern that maybe we have all of this opportunity to develop new apps and decentralized apps and new technological solutions, but maybe special interests or a fear of that will stifle innovation and prevent that from happening, and we'll see bans, and we'll see that it doesn't actually actualize its potential just because maybe there's fatigue around crime and there's fatigue around the price fluctuations and all of this stuff happens in a way that kind of eventually just dies out, and then what could have been a really disruptive future doesn't actually kind of play out. Now that I guess that's my biggest concern.
Well, when Mike and I get our crypto off the ground, we'll be sure to invite you as early investors. Then we can all retire very soon.
Scrapping the plans to do an NFT, I'll tell you that. Thank you, Eric. And thank you, Kim. Unless you have any more questions, Sean, I want to thank you guys very much for sharing your time with us, and like Sean said, once we get our crypto up and running, we'll get you to come back and maybe you can review it and tell us what we've done right or wrong.
No, it was very informative. Thank you. I'm thinking about this issue in ways that I haven't before. I appreciate the education, appreciate the dialogue, and hope that we can have you back sometime in the future.
At the end of the day, I know a lot more than I did before. So I want to shout out to Alan Gates, our producer as well, who shows up and makes us sound good and cuts out all the stupid things we say in the middle. So,
thanks to the three of you.
Thank you so much. Thanks, you all.
Cheers. Bye. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Educated Conjecture. Follow us on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts for another episode of Public Opinion and Informed Insights. If you have a topic you'd like to see covered on an upcoming episode, please send us an email at publicaffairs@ipsos.com. That's publicaffairs@ipsos.com.